Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today I'm talking to Stuart McGill and Vince Raisin, the authors of a fascinating new book, The Roaring Red Front, the world's top left-wing football clubs. They've travelled around the world visiting soccer clubs which have a reputation for left-wing politics, talking to fans, sampling the matched atmosphere and exploring the histories of a diverse range of clubs. They've gone from Dulwich Hamlet to Detroit City, Boca Juniors in Argentina to St. Pauli in Germany and many, many more in between. It's a book that's not only about politics and football, but it's also about the role that football plays in people's lives, how it brings them together, and also how it separates them. And to declare my interest, I was very honoured by the fact that Stuart and Vince asked me to write the foreword to the book. So, conflicts of interest out the way. Welcome to the show, Stuart and Vince.
Thanks for having us, Tony.
Cheers, Tony. Thanks very much.
Good to have you on. So, to start right at the very beginning with an obvious question, why did you decide to write the book?
I think simply it was a book we wanted to read. There are lots of books about these clubs that we've admired from afar, but there's nothing that tied them all together. And going to St. Pauli with Stuart, we got to see just how big that left-wing football family is. And we wanted to reflect that and also talk about our travels, how much fun we had.
Don't talk about the fun too much there, Vince. I'm trying to convince my wife even now that it was all hard work. Right. For me, it was the trip to St. Pauli was great. Remember, we went to Rayo Vallecano, I think, in January 2019. And there were a bunch of kids from Celta Vigo. Now, Celta Vigo are also a vaguely left-wing leaning team. So you had those Vigo fans that were giving high fives to the Rayo Vallecano fans. And they had the big pan-Celtic flag. So I stopped for a wee chat with them, a very nice bunch of young men who were off to Derry a couple of weeks after to take part in some kind of left-wing conference across there. And that struck me then, maybe there is something more to this. There is some kind of potential network of lefties unified through football. And then whenever Vince, I didn't get a chance to go to the Hamburg Derby because my kid was ill, but Vince went to see it and there were representatives of so many clubs from across the globe there. St. Pauli is truly a global phenomenon. A Mickey Mouse football team in many ways, but you had people from Marseille there. They have fan clubs in India. And that's when I thought, we really do have to write something about this. And something also which was quite critical and analytical and talked about the place of left-wing clubs in politics in general. I wanted to write that rather than just the usual hagiography of how great their fans are.
I mean, it's quite a wide range of clubs as well. I mean, not just geographically, but also in terms of the extent to which you can call them left-wing and the different traditions and the histories. How did you go about choosing? Because I think, is it 11 clubs that you've got there?
Yeah, we gave a chapter to a first 11 of clubs. Who were probably the more prominent ones around the world. We were looking for clubs that were proudly anti-fascist and anti-racist and against all kinds of discrimination. But often that would be reflected in the fans rather than the clubs. Not all the clubs were great supporters of left-wing politics at all, but all the fans were. Of course, the internet is a very useful tool, and one club led to another. As Stuart said, we went to Rio and we met Celta Vigo fans. And when you go to St. Pauli, you meet Rio fans and Celtic fans. So we were really looking for clubs that opposed fascism, and that's there are in countries that have experienced it. There's a very strong anti-fascist feeling among some, and there's quite fervent opposition too in Germany and Spain and in Italy.
From my point of view, I agree with everything Vince said there, but there was also variety and a little bit off the beaten track. I didn't want to cover just the regular clubs that everybody kind of knows about, and also clubs that posed the question we'll talk about later, what does it actually mean to be left-wing? And clubs that give us interesting stories that tell us something about other cultures and, places that we don't know about. Because even though both Palestino and Boca Juniors aren't classic lefty clubs like St. Pauli, but those two chapters for me were some of the more interesting in the book, not just because I wrote them, but also it was a good trip out there. But I thought there's quite a bit in there that your regular football and political reader would not actually know. Particularly in Chile, because the unity of football fans there became a bit of a symbol for the social uprising. That picture of the fans from three of the Santiago clubs that normally beat the crap out of each other together, that became very important to the movement. And again, one thing we wanted to actually show in the book is that football does matter.
Yeah, and I think this is the interesting question that surprised me when I was reading it, that normally I think when you think about left-wing football clubs, you think about clubs that have made declarations that, you know, are on the left, that are anti-fascist, that are potentially anti-capitalist. But whereas you've kind of drawn a much broader bow, because I was surprised to find Liverpool there, not a club that certainly from an official level that you'd associate with it, with any type of left-wing stance. So, did you have to think about including Liverpool, or were they an automatic inclusion because of what you know about the fans? And I think it's undeniable that there's always been a section of Liverpool fans that has seen themselves and have been seen as leftist.
We certainly had to have a debate about it, because I mean, any club that is in the Premier League has already signed up to keeping money with the richest and cutting off the stream to grassroots football. Same with the Champions League. It's all about keeping money within the elite. But the fans certainly are very left-wing. Not all of them. There's no kind of homogeneity in any group that large. But they have a history going back to Shankly and possibly beyond, and also their opposition to the Sun. Those kind of things have made them not a shoo-in, but we had to have that debate because it's a very capitalist club in a very capitalist industry.
For me, the two clubs I follow in England are Arsenal and Everton. So I have no instinctive love of Liverpool FC, and I've had some very interesting visits to Liverpool as an away fan. So it was tough, but I think it was worth doing because, like Vince said, there is an interesting political and football story to be told there. The way the city responded to, the assault by Thatcher in the 80s, and also the response of the right-wing press, particularly the Sun, to the Hillsborough disaster, has certainly helped to radicalise that city and large parts of the football following. And every week you see more and more manifestations of Liverpool fans becoming a proper left-wing club, which is good to see. Whenever the fascists go and march in Liverpool, very few turn up and they get kicked out of the place quite quickly. So, I mean, the venture capitalists who run the club, they're by no means comrades, but what is interesting is that such was the response of the fans to the European Super League. They sat down and listened to the Spirit of Shankly group, and they now have put together quite an interesting model of how football fans can work with a management which isn't instinctively sympathetic to left-wing views or even democracy. And it does seem to have a potential model for the future way clubs are run. So it was an interesting story. I will always, however, celebrate a Liverpool defeat, particularly by Napoli this week. That had me laughing for quite a large part of the time. And then the Queen died.
I don't think you're alone in that, yeah. I mean, I think the other thing, just to go on the Liverpool thing a little bit more, the influence of Bill Shankly, the fact that he was a self-proclaimed socialist, and that the, as you say, the supporters group, the independent supporters group, is called Spirit of Shankly, makes them quite distinctive, I think, in English football anyway, because they've actually got that direct example or direct link with Shankly's politics, and the Shankly was the manager that began everything for the club, essentially. It makes it a lot more powerful than what it would be at other clubs, I think.
Yeah, and Shankly also felt a parallel between socialism and football in that it's a team game. It's not for somebody to shine. It's everybody's effort working together towards a positive end.
So I was going to say, I think Shankly does actually transcend any sort of club loyalties. The man he was and some of the quotes he made, particularly the one we talk in the book about how you have respect for the bin men, you have respect for Labour in general. He was just one hell of a guy. If Shankly had managed Rangers, I'd still probably forgive him, though it would be more difficult. And I'm sure he would have left Rangers quite early on anyway.
Yeah, that would be an interesting conundrum, wouldn't it? Developing that a bit, how did you come to define left wing when you're looking at the clubs? Because obviously, football's football. It's a commercial enterprise. There are lots of different people supporting clubs for lots of different reasons. As you mentioned earlier on, in terms of Spain, they're obviously, because of the legacy of the Spanish Civil War, and the divisions that that led to, you know, that continue even today, then that's led to some clubs being identified with anti-Francoist, anti-fascist attitudes. But in general, I mean, it's quite a wide range of clubs. As we've just been saying, Liverpool, but also Boca Juniors, for example. Did you lay down any principles, or did you draw any lines about how far you could go before, you know, a club couldn't be considered left wing, or conversely, you know, did you put anything down? In, you know, did you have a criteria for selecting the left wing nature of clubs?
I don't think we actually did. No, but we did discuss the merits of all the clubs involved, and lots of them don't actually consider themselves left wing. They might consider themselves just humanitarian. Although, from the right perspective, humanitarianism can be considered left wing. You know, absurdly, but it can. And lots of clubs like Dulwich Hamlet consider themselves apolitical, but the fans are very left wing, and they support all sorts of initiatives to welcome refugees and collect for them. They're perceived as left-wing by somebody. But Boca Juniors is an interesting one because they're kind of wrapped up in Peronism, which is incredibly complicated in itself and can be considered left-wing and right-wing. Same at Bahia. They didn't really want to consider themselves left-wing because they were sticking up for all sorts of causes that were not appreciated by Bolsonaro, for instance. It was difficult, and we had to struggle with Celtic, of course, because, I mean, there's some Celtic fans have questioned why they're not in the first 11. They are in the book, of course. But I think they probably know the reason for that, because the sectarian nature of some of the support makes it difficult to justify that inclusion.
From my point of view, I was interested in doing Boca because Argentinian politics is odd and quite fascinating. And it kind of brings out whenever you look at, are Boca a left-wing team? They call themselves the people side. That a lot of it is about emotion and not about going through Marx's Capital and understanding all three volumes. It's about emotion. You're for the people. Peronism is a very problematic political movement, whether right Peronism or left Peronism. But someone like Maradona, he showed himself to be a big fan of Boca because he was a man of the people. And if you're presenting yourself in Argentina as that man of the people, it's unlikely you'll become a fan of River. So there's an emotional kind of mystical element to it there. And it's a hell of an interesting club to visit. And we thought the story was worth telling. And I think the story does bring out some interesting things about Argentinian politics and about left-wing sentiment as well. The same with Palestino. It's a cause, or they stand for a cause, which is attractive to many left-wing people. Many Palestino fans are not left-wing, but they do tend to attract people in Chile that are, like that Bulgarian guy that I talk about in the book. We met the guy doing some painting of a statue in the middle of Santiago, and he was a Bulgarian communist. Young guy, his family went across there in the late 70s, and he was a big Palestino fan. And his mate was an American Communist Party member from Kansas, who'd gone down there to learn Spanish. So there are interesting stories wherever you look. And so I was mostly concerned with bringing out some stories that people may not have heard before about parts of the world they don't know much about, rather than just focusing on the big, obvious left-wing clubs.
I thought what was really interesting about the book was, obviously, there's a lot of history in there, but it's the actual, when you go to matches and you speak to people, and you get a real sense, and I think the book does this really well, you get a real sense of what the club is about for the fans. And I think that's an interesting point about what the nature of a club is, because when it comes down to it, owners come and go, players come and go, managers come and go, even stadiums change, but what remains are the people who are fans of that club. And I think that one of the things that you can kind of draw out from your reportage of the different matches and the different clubs you went to is the way in which, in a sense, the spirit of each club is kept alive through its supporters. The one thing the club cannot change or cannot do without is its supporters. So I thought the book was very interesting from that point of view, in terms of addressing from a particular angle what actually makes it a football club and why that club is important.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Tony. Yeah, you can't understand the nature of a club by looking at the boardroom. You have to look at the people who go and who will be, who were there before whoever's working there started, and will be there after they've gone as well. Yeah, definitely. The nature of a club is found on its terraces.
Absolutely. And it says something about the area, and it says something about the country overall, of course. And one of the things that I was quite keen in doing in this book, and maybe we didn't do it wholly perfectly, was kind of rehabilitating football fans. Because, I mean, football is massive. It's important to so many people across the world. And this is what Galliano talks about as the great void in history. People can write, how can you write the history of Scotland, say, in the 19th and 20th century without talking about football? The same with Argentina, Brazil. The same about England. I mean, England is a massive football country, and football is important to a huge number of people. But they are the people who are often forgotten, excluded and contemned by history and the middle class people that write history. Because the working class don't matter. It's just seen as a circus to distract them. So we wanted to try and correct that to a certain extent. I think we did it somewhat imperfectly, but we talk about this in the conclusion and some of the political lessons that can be learned from our travels.
Was there anything that surprised you when you went to visit the clubs in terms of either the intensity of fans' political beliefs or... just in terms of your expectations of what supporters of that club or that club itself would be, was there anything that kind of jarred against your impressions before you got there, or things that were pleasantly surprising?
I think when I went to St. Pauli, and when I was warned off of taking photographs on the street because there were people there who might be doing pyro later and that sort of thing, it seemed very... It didn't have any of the kind of laid-back sense that there was on the terraces in the Sud Curva when everybody is drinking beer and smoking weed. That was a surprise. There is tension outside the ground in Hamburg. The Hamburg Derby, having a beer after the game at St. Pauli Eck and seeing the lines of police officers in helmets, armed police officers, just there in case it kicks off, and you know you don't want to kick off against the German police. It wasn't given the laid back nature of the lefty football, that was quite a surprise.
I was somewhat surprised the second time that I went to St. Pauli. I enjoyed it a little bit less than the first, partly because it's all a little bit choreographed, and an accusation you can level against the ultra movement in general is they take themselves a little seriously, and I think that's certainly true of some elements of St. Pauli. Maybe in Cosenza too. In Cosenza we had that great incident wherever the team, after an abysmal performance, were called by the guy with the megaphone who was leading our little group of ultras to come and stand and face abuse for about 5 minutes. And that was interesting, but the guys actually felt the right as ultras to demand the team stand there and get the abuse. Generally speaking, we had a great time in Cosenza. It's not a town or a people that take themselves too seriously, but there was that level of aggression. We met the guy by chance the day afterwards and had a nice wee conversation with the guy, and he was suitably embarrassed about his people. But football matters, and the ultras, they regard themselves as mattering as well. I was surprised when I went to Boca. What a happy crowd it was. Argentina is my favourite place to visit. I've been there many times, but they can take themselves a little bit seriously and they take football a bit seriously. But this was just one massive party. I think because many people, like me, were tourists from inside Argentina, maybe. It's really tough to get a ticket. It's damned expensive to get a ticket. So they were there determined to just have a great time. And the football didn't matter. It was just about having a proper little party on the terraces. That kind of surprised me for a nation which can sometimes find it tough to relax. Prague, I think I've been on for a long time. Sorry, you guys get back to talking. I could talk about this all day.
No, that's fine. I'll tell you one of the things that occurred to me just when you're talking about the ultras is that, and again, it goes back to sort of how left wing are these, women in football, obviously with the massive success of the Euros, but it does appear that a lot of football culture, and particularly ultra football culture, is very macho. So, I mean, what about the role of women in these left-wing clubs, in the left-wing culture of these clubs? Is that something that's, that needs a lot of work on? Or what were your impressions?
Certainly noticed there was quite a good gender mix at Red Star in Paris. There's a lot more women there. I don't know whether that's something that they've helped with. And I mean, there's certainly... I know what you mean about the kind of macho culture that, yeah, does kind of pervade a lot of football. There's certainly lots of women at St. Pauli, but St. Pauli has that problematic relationship with well, the city has a problematic relationship with prostitution, and there's a bar that has a box there. Is it Susie's Bar? I can't remember. Some strip joint, basically, and you know that's not inclusive. You know, that's kind of pushing women away and to think, is this the right thing for me? And so yeah, we have to be critical as well. You know, it's not just because the majority of fans are left wing doesn't mean they there's not a lot to learn, and still a lot of things that need changing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was very critical in the St. Pauli chapter about the attitude towards women shown by Herbert Strasser, where they have a big sign up saying no guys under 18 in here and no women. This is the big place, the big red light street where they have the girls in the windows. And I thought there was a general, somewhat uncritical attitude to that, held by some St. Pauli fans as well, and they just saw it as part of the city and part of the history. Well, Christ, slavery was part of history, but it's not something that you look up to as anything which should be preserved. Also, I was writing that chapter in St. Pauli when I was in Santiago, and in Santiago, all over the place, you see graffiti saying basically, La revolución será feminista o no será. The revolution will be feminist or it will not be. And that made an impact probably on my writing at the time, because I was quite critical of that. The only place I remember seeing a good proportion of women was Red Star Paris. There were women in the St. Pauli Sud Curve, but it was overwhelmingly male, and it was overwhelmingly a very male-dominated culture as well. So I think that as in many aspects of life, football, ultra, beg your pardon, not just football, ultra culture, women do need to take a more prominent role, and that will probably change the character of the support as well, which will be a good thing.
Which kind of leads me on to the next question, is that do you think there are limits to how far a football club operating in a commercial environment can go in terms of espousing left-wing causes? Because to survive, and St. Pauli, you know, are a good example of this, there's a contradiction there, isn't there, between the commercial needs of running a professional football club and supporting left-wing causes. Did you come across any evidence that that was either that was an issue or that was acknowledged and it was something people were trying to deal with, or was it just not an issue? It was just enough to be able to express your opinions, and that was as far as it went.
Well, certainly at St. Pauli, yeah, we spoke with the president there, Oppo Gutlick, and he wants St. Pauli to be as big as possible. He wants to get them promoted to the Bundesliga, and he wants them to get into the Champions League. But that's because he wants to be able to spread the message that they have throughout the world. They just want to be able to be louder and to keep their integrity, but to do so on as big a stage as possible. I think he was saying that there are those on the left wing of football who don't really aren't that bothered about winning. You know, it's not the most important thing. It's about having a good time, which I can understand. Yeah, he thinks there's nothing wrong with winning, and I can't say there is anything wrong with winning. He wants to just keep the spirit of the club, even if they do go into a more commercial sphere like the Champions League, which is a long way off, I have to say. But nothing's impossible.
I think there's always going to be compromises and conflicts, and it will remain a dialectical situation irrespective of how the wider society is structured. It's basically a competitive sport here, and people do want to win. And you're up against the basic left-wing idea of nobody wins unless everybody wins. So there's always going to be conflict. I always think of my cousin, who was a huge Chelsea fan. He was sort of Chelsea fan that would go and watch Luton or Wimbledon on a Tuesday night with about 7,000 others. Once Abramovich took over, he left. he went off and he supported his wife's team, Leicester. So he must have been gutted whenever they won the Premiership. But there is that element of football fan. I probably include myself in this as well. I kind of support Arsenal down here, but I'm kind of repelled by the way Arsenal is run by now and by the people that run Arsenal. So I don't really care. I think it depends how you get success, and it's what you do with the success. Red Star, Vince. Remember, they had Vince knows more about this than I do, but shortly after we met them. Explain what happened, Vince, because I can't remember the details.
Yeah, they got basically taken over by an American financial group that own some sports clubs in America and invest in various clubs around the world. So the ground has been developed. It's been quite ramshackle for a long time. There's only got one side open at the moment. And they've been trying to, it's owned by the city, and they've been trying to get it developed for a long time. And really, the only solution they found is to go in with these investors who are putting a lot of money into making a very swanky stadium. And there are a lot of fans that are very sceptical about getting into bed with these guys. It's the area that they play in, Saint-Ouen in Paris, is a hotbed of football talent, and they're concerned that instead of seeing these players play for Red Star, they'll end up going to one of the other kind of network of clubs that this company own. And yeah, it remains to be seen how it works out with I think 777 Partners, I think they're called. But yeah, there's certainly a few fans who are very concerned that the spirit of the club is going to be tarnished by money.
Yes, you agree with what Vince said there. And it reminds me of the conversation with a Celtic fan up in Glasgow last week, a fellow party member. And he said that Celtic in the old days, in the early 80s, whenever unemployment increased massively because of Thatcher's idiosyncratic view of what was good for the Scottish economy, used to let you in for half price, I think, if you had a UB40. But Celtic apparently recently stopped paying a living wage, and so he doesn't go ahead and support them anymore. I think there's always going to be that conflict, going to be that tension. And you might love the idea of the club, but sometimes the actuality gets in the way. And I must confess, at the moment, and certainly after the experience of writing this book and the travelling, I don't care if I see a Premiership game ever again. The quality of football, they're great. Some of the games I've seen on TV this season have been fantastic, but there is just almost everything about the game I cannot stand.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's something that's happening in all spectator sports that I think the negativity within the sport, particularly on the terraces, it's a kind of lightning rod for something else that's going on in society, for general frustrations in society. That, you know, this is the one place where all, you know, not only can you vent, but kind of all that toxic stuff that's built up during the week because of the way you've been treated, frustrations with what's going on in the world and everything else, it just pours out in this, often in just a horrible form of bile on a football pitch. And I think that's been true for quite a long time, but it just seems to be getting a lot worse. I think as football itself becomes much, much more corporate, and the whole thing about the European Super League, it's kind of highlighted all that crap that's been poured down on people. I mean, that's not to excuse the racism and the homophobia and everything else that people come out with at football, but there's a direct link with what's going on in the world today with that.
It's too expensive for one thing. I can't afford to go to a Premier League. I don't support a Premier League team, but if I did, I really could not afford to go and see them.
I think it's also the mentality and the attitudes on display. Yeah, I was offered some tickets for Celtic v Rangers last weekend, £350. I'm not going to pay that. That's ridiculous. And also the cost of getting up there and so on. But it's also the mentalities that you encounter there. Because I remember, Vince, we talked about this a while ago. You're a Charlton man. And my son is not a football fan, but he went to Charlton a few times too. And he was appalled at the attitudes there. And I think you find it a bit wearing after a while too.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's this great entitlement. Everyone thinks they should be winning every game. And as I'm sure you find out, you've found at Arsenal before, And yeah, it's kind of toxic and unpleasant. And when that happens, and that's why I go to Dulwich Hamlet. It's there's not that you don't feel obliged to abuse either your own team or the opposition. It kind of baffles me why. I suppose people like to vent at football, don't they? It's a way of being able to do that. And but I tell you what, week after week, it's tiresome and depressing. Even without racism and homophobia, the abuse that footballers and referees take, in no other sphere would you use that language to describe a person. It's not a very admirable trait. I'm happy to turn my back on that now, and I enjoy non-league football much more. The camaraderie is better, and it's a lot more civilized.
I think to a certain extent we're romanticising the past of football. I remember some hideous abuse and some hideous things being said and done back in the 70s and 80s of football. And I've seen a lot of football. So I think it was always there. The big difference I find now is the feeling of entitlement to success. Even at Arsenal in the late 70s when I started going, that wasn't there. I think certainly after they won the league in 89, if you weren't 3-0 up at half-time, then people got angry. That's one of the things that forced me to look elsewhere. So it's that entitlement to success. And also, everybody's a master tactician these days. Fans would never talk about that. We lost because basically the other side had more bottle than us. People come out with that sort of stuff rather than talking about Christmas tree formation, using the sweeper, that sort of stuff. And I blame that on television to a certain extent, because my own view is that tactics are a load of old crap. It's the side with the better players that wins. But that's another podcast.
I think that disqualifies you from any hipster football podcasts.
Thank God for that. That's mission accomplished there.
Well, I was going to ask, to look on a brighter note, I think one of the things that comes across in the book, there's a tremendous sense of joy about going to these games and mixing with these supporters from all different nationalities around the world. What were your most memorable moments?
I think going to Cosenza, which was a place full of surprises, and being approached by tattooed skinheads who invited us to come for breakfast beers the next day at their restaurant, and finding such a kinship with these guys, that was a real surprise and a real joy. But generally speaking, in Cosenza, in Prague, in Hamburg, in Cardiff, it was that we could barely buy a drink. People they were so generous with their time, but also with their beer. That's the most memorable thing for me, I think.
For me, it was Santiago and Buenos Aires. I've been there many times, but I still love the cities. My friend Carlos in Santiago, who was my translator. My Spanish is not bad, but it needs a bit of help, and he was very good. He was a Chilean refugee who spent some time, Tony. I think he spent some time in Hull. He must have felt pretty bad escaping Pinochet and having to spend some time in Hull, but he managed to move away after a while.
There's a lot of Chilean refugees after 1973 came to Hull, a very big Chile solidarity campaign there in the 70s. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah, I take the mick out of Hull, sorry, but yeah, Hull did stand in solidarity, so fair play to the city. A great guy who I really enjoyed having contact with across there. I met Daniel Jadu, who's the communist mayor for Recoleta in northern Chile, and he gets 65% of the vote there, which rather puts in shadow my 1% I think he got in Blackheath a while ago, but Recoleta is quite a different place from Blackheath. Cosenza was amazing in general. Prague, I love Prague, the fact that you actually paid on the door with cash when you went in. They had a bar, three sides of the terrace. You could drink there, smoke. And it was a good, relaxed atmosphere. I remember you talk about people taking themselves too seriously. These guys didn't. The goalkeeper off the opposition side got a little bit narky when they were taking the mickey out of them. And there was a general feeling of, hang loose, mate. It's only a game. We're just having a laugh here. That was good. The hangover in Prague was the worst I've ever experienced. I guess a few people have said that. And the 8-hour queue for a ticket in Rayo Vallecano, for the Rayo Vallecano game. That was memorable. And I met some very nice new friends whenever I was in the queue. So you're right, Tony. It was an absolute joy to do. Despite the problems of travelling at the time of COVID, we could probably write a separate book about that.
So I guess that brings me on to my final point, which is sort of connected anyway, that the experiences that you had, what are the lessons that you can take from that?
I think one of the lessons I learned was that left-wing unity is possible. I saw that in St. Pauli in particular. You know, they're a very well-run club. They're a model club in many respects. And the German model of having the fans own 50% plus one of the club is one that really is a healthy one. And we see the Premier League awash with money from undesirable regimes that could never happen in Germany. They all seem to be on the same page. Everybody's a member. The president is just a member, same as the fan on the terraces. But sadly, that's not the case everywhere. We also saw how divided even people of a similar political persuasion can be. We saw that in Cosenza, where there's one group in one stand and another in the other, and they're basically rivals while supporting the same team. And we saw that at Clapton when we went to a match there. And they really don't like Dulwich Hamlet. They're probably the only two left-wing clubs in London. And there's zero unity there. You know, that was a bit of a shocker.
Yeah, Clapton fans really do not like you, Vince. I've noticed that on Twitter over the last couple of days, and the sense of entitlement. I mean, as you said, there were more words in the piece that we wrote on Clapton, the small piece, than there were fans there. All right, I think they should be glad that we actually gave them any coverage whatsoever. That's one that might be even more. For me, the big lesson was that football actually matters, and that politicians of the left in particular should not ignore it. I'm thinking about the fan project in Germany that we talk about in the conclusion. Certainly, German football took a rather unpleasant Nazi-supporting tinge in the 80s. That's why so many fans of SV Hamburger went to support St. Pauli. It seems odd to be able to change a football club for us, but they did, because they're getting next to idiot Nazis, and because the Germans have a particularly unpleasant and they're quite honest about their history, they felt able to go ahead and support a club that wasn't run by Nazis. The fan project got in there, worked with German supporters, and they fought that element. And now when you watch a German game, a large number of the players are African. There is very little, almost no racist chanting. By no means All Saints and Hansa Rostock, the East German club, who are a big rival of St. Pauli, they have some very uncomfortable fans. But they made an effort with the supporters. And I think about the lost opportunity in the 70s. And again, we talk about this in a conclusion. You had Millwall led by Tiny, who was a black guy, and you had the Chelsea firm led, along with Eccles, by One Arm Babs, another black guy. So racist fans led by a black guy. There was an opportunity to get in there and to actually spread a non-racist, inclusive message to football fans. And had that been done, we wouldn't have had to endure the racism and football terraces we have over the last couple of decades. It would have changed the content of conversations and maybe even the direction of our football. Because if you look at Italy now, a very right-wing ultra football culture and depressingly right-wing politics. German politics are by no means perfect, but the alternative for Deutschland is stuck about 12%. Regular liberal politics do seem to survive in Germany the way they do not in Italy. So a very long way of saying football matters and politicians ignore it at their peril, particularly politicians from the left.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. So, well, thanks very much, Stuart and Vince. It's been a huge pleasure and very educational to have you on the podcast. So just to remind listeners, the book is called The Roaring Red Front, The World's Top Left-Wing Football Clubs by Stuart McGill and Vince Raisin, and it's published by Pitch Publishing. You can find a link to the book on my webpage. And as I'm sure you know by now, my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, as we've been talking about today. So until next time, thanks for listening.